First case on the docket, I believe, is Ragsdale versus, and Davis versus Bailey, is that correct? Those attorneys can set up if you wish. And then I'll make a short record for both cases. Good afternoon, this is Division 3, the Colorado Court of Appeals. We are assembled this afternoon to hear arguments in two cases. I would point out that this is the first regularly scheduled argument in this courtroom. Another division of this course usurped us from being the first by scheduling a continued case for Friday afternoon. So now we can't claim to be the first, but we can claim to be the first regularly scheduled. We are convened to hear two cases. The first is Ragsdale and Davis versus Bailey, case number 2009 CA 821, and the second is Burke Simpson Eldridge et al. Versus the city of Central, or Central City. Let me make a short record before we start arguing them both. First of all, the arguments have been set for 15 minutes per side. You can use that time any way you desire. We would indicate to you that we have all read the briefs. We've read some of the authority cited in the briefs, perhaps not all. And we're fairly familiar with the facts. One of us has been into the record to some considerable extent. So we would recommend that you not devote very much of your precious time to facts and that sort of thing, but if you want to, that's the time is yours. But we would suggest you go directly to the legal issues. This being a new courtroom, I don't know that everything I'm going to say is correct, but the lectern is equipped with a microphone. The purpose of the microphone is to amplify the sound in the room as well as digitally record the arguments. The digitally recorded arguments are on the internet within a day or two after argument if you want to listen to them again. We sometimes use them in the preparation of an opinion, so we would like to have a clear recording, and in order to do that, we would ask you remain at or near the lectern so that we don't lose track of your voice in the course of the argument. There are toggle switches on the lectern that, at least over in the old courthouse, used to raise and lower it, and I assume it does here. If you find the lectern too high or too low, please feel free to adjust it to your comfort prior to beginning your argument. I guess the last thing is, well, a couple of things. If the appellant wishes me to save or assist you in saving time for rebuttal, let me know, and I'll be happy to help you. There is a digital module on the lectern which counts down your time. The light will be green for the first 10, yellow or orange for the next 5, and red when the argument's over. So you'll be constantly aware of how much time you have, but if you want me to wave at you or grunt or do something, I have to do that. Lastly, if anyone has cell phones, Blackberries, iPhones, or other devices that make noise unexpectedly, would you please turn it off or at a minimum put it on silent? And if you're in the audience and you have such a device, please leave the courtroom prior to answering it or responding to it, if it's on silent, so as not to disturb counsel and the court in the course of what I think will be a conversation. We call it an argument, but I prefer to call it a conversation. That is to say, the questions will be frequent and hopefully answerable, but frequent. Are there any questions about how we're going to proceed? If not, we're ready for the first case.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Lisa Secor, S-E-C-O-R, number 25394. I'm here on behalf of Simler and Associates, representing William Bailey, who is also here. And This is a case where Mr. Bailey was originally the cross appellant. The appellant dropped the appeal, and so this is the remaining portion. I won't go into the record or the brief. One thing in reading the briefs that I thought didn't really come out was more of an overview of what happened in this case. And looking at trying to see it from Judge Holmes' point of view, I could kind of see how he looked at it. What he seemed to look at was he looked at it as if, well, the Mr. Bailey also had a counterclaim deck action, declaratory action, seeking for a determination that the easement was valid. He prevailed on that declaratory judgment and therefore wasn't entitled to attorney's fees and costs under the American rule that doesn't permit it. I see this,
the only issue we're dealing with is the cases which, or the claims which he found to be vexatious or groundless and meritless.
Well, he did find the trespass claims of the plaintiff vexatious and groundless, and they had failed to drop them till the last minute, and Mr. Bailey was awarded $10,500, which the court had determined was the portion of the fees for defending that. However, I would submit to the court that the substance of this case is really a little bit different. In substance, Mr. Bailey would have never filed a deck action seeking proof of his easement if the plaintiff hadn't defensively first filed the deck action saying that there wasn't an easement, or that it had been extinguished by adverse possession or merger or some other theory.
Well, he ultimately would have had to do something to gain access to his property if he wanted to use the easement.
The easement was of record and well known among all the owners of the property, and he did all that he should have had to do, which is send a letter out and say, I'm intending to build a road at this time. When you see construction people out there, you know what's going on. The easement was very, very clear. It was in the record. The plaintiffs had taken the position of ignorance from the very beginning, claiming they didn't realize there was an easement, they didn't know. But what came out at trial was, not only did they know at the time they purchased two different lots, one in 2001 and 2005, their property, their title commitment showed that these easements were of record. Second of all, before Mr. Bailey ever even purchased his lot, the plaintiffs had the easement on their own property surveyed. We called the surveyor to trial, and he produced the check written by Darla Davis on April 29, 2005, paying the surveyor. The surveyor testified at trial the way he set the easement was from the language in the plaintiff's deed.
Do you want us to find that the defense of the plaintiff's claims with respect to the easement were also frivolous and groundless? Could the trial court especially decline to do that?
Yes, I think so.
And is our review de novo, or do we have to give some credence to the trial court's determination in that regard?
Because it's a question of law, I think you have to review it de novo.
So we have to determine separately whether the defense or whether the seeking to apply a title to get rid of the easement was frivolous or not.
Yes, in the first instance, because that's what initiated the whole lawsuit that went on for 2.5 years.
Doesn't that depend upon the facts?
Well, I think you can use the facts that the trial court found. The trial court specifically found that the plaintiff stated, you better have deep pockets because I'm going to fight you till hell freezes over.
Did the trial court specifically find that the plaintiffs knew about the easement prior to initiating the lawsuit? You said there was evidence to that effect, but did the trial court make that finding? Was there conflicting evidence on that?
There was not conflicting evidence. There was no dispute. The evidence at trial showed that the plaintiffs knew about the easement before they purchased their property, vis-a-vis both title commitment policies. Two, they had it surveyed in '05, they had their handyman specifically build fences 2 feet outside of the easement so they wouldn't have to move the fences later. So they well knew about the easement. I think that's undisputed in the record.
Didn't they argue that easement had somehow been dissolved by non-use, by merger, by other theories that ultimately were not successful?
They argued every theory there is about an easement, and not one of them had factual support. In most instances, the facts disputed what they tried to argue. For example, they said, well, there was a merger because all the property was owned by one person. If you follow the deeds they themselves presented in the motion for summary judgment, it shows that wasn't true. They tried to say that there was a merger, that later one person bought them all. Again, the deeds they themselves submitted showed it wasn't true. They tried to say the deeds didn't show the language of the declaration when it was specifically referenced in both of their deeds. And as later the surveyor testified, he measured it based on the language in the deeds themselves. So they knew, and that's undisputed. They were told by two different attorneys, one in March of 2006, one in February of 06, and March of 08. Their initial claim was adverse possession. They hadn't even owned the property 7 years. So even under the summary adverse possession statute, they couldn't have had adverse possession. When this was pointed out to them, then all of a sudden they made the arguments about merger, the arguments about extinguishment of right. They made up an argument that until the subdivision lands are sold, there can be no easement. Well, all the lots have been sold. How could that possibly be an argument? And the trial court specifically found as to each of these arguments that either there were no facts supporting them, the facts the plaintiff themselves presented contradicted them, that there was no argument, that is, the argument was pure speculation or pure argument and nothing supporting it, or that the law didn't support the point they were trying to make. In one case, they cited a case that proved the opposite point, and that was pointed out in the motion for summary judgment. So the trial court specifically found in each case that the claims of the plaintiff on the quiet title action were groundless and frivolous, and yet he said...
He didn't make that finding.
Well, he
didn't draw that conclusion. I've read your briefs, he may have criticized those theories that were defended, but he never found that they were vexatious or groundless.
Right, and our argument is the statute says when you find these things, when you find that there is the claim is groundless, there's no case law, there's no argument, that it's stubbornly litigious, you shall award the person who had to defend those claims attorney's fees and costs. And so all the court did is he just didn't link what the statute says is groundless and frivolous with a conclusion that it was groundless and frivolous. And that's the only thing that barred Mr. Bailey from being able to have his attorney's fees and costs awarded. And I know Mr. Bailey would like me to point out that the whole purpose of the plaintiff's complaint, deck action that they brought, the quiet title, the whole point of it was just to delay and prevent him from building his road. Every time we knocked out the first set of defenses, a brand new set of defenses, each set equally frivolous as the first. Even up at trial, they were arguing that because the particular book and page, the original, wasn't in the clerk's office for about, there were a few days, a couple weeks before Bailey brought his property, that they weren't in the clerk's office, that somehow undermined the easement and therefore it wasn't valid. Of course, we brought the clerk of the county to court and she said, well, even if the realtor couldn't find it that day, we always have a backup copy and all anybody had to do was ask for it and we would have produced it. So it wasn't ever actually missing, they just couldn't find it at that time. We also brought Mr. Sheridan from the city of Elizabeth and he said that he just walked he wanted to know for his own self whether or not there was an easement, and he just walked in and found it. And so even right up to the day of trial, they were trying to undermine the easement. And so it's not that they had valid defenses. All they had was a motivation to block the road. And they thought Mr. Bailey, a poor man, a house rebuilder who didn't have much means, and they knew it, they thought they could just keep him in litigation and wait him out and hope that he would not be able to prevail 2.5 years of litigation.
That's your argument. That's not the court's finding. The court never made the finding, did it, that any of these claims or defenses were brought to delay or harass?
And I have to end here in just a moment because I want a little bit of time for rebuttal. But the court specifically found at the very first meeting with the parties that Mr. Ragsdale stood there and told Mr. Bailey, I hope you have deep pockets because I do, and this is going to get litigated. At a time when he knew the easement was completely valid. There's no other reason to say that than to say, we're going to litigate this for the sake of litigating it.
Did the court give Mr. Bailey some attorney's fees in connection with the defense of their easement claim or in connection with his counterclaim?
No, the court specifically found that he would only award attorney's fees for having to defend the trespass claim, of which there wasn't a scintilla of evidence that Mr. Bailey had done anything but walk along his own easement.
No, the court said that when I read his order. He said a portion of the general work performed in connection with defending against plaintiff's claims prior to withdrawal of trespass and harassment allegation is applicable to those claims. The court finds that $10,000 was reasonably necessary to incur. I'm not sure whether the judge gave you some attorney's fees for the other claims as well. Your position is he only gave you for defending the first and second claims.
Yes, and that was my clear understanding from him at trial.
Mr. Bailey now wants the attorney's fees for defending whatever other claims the plaintiff's brought up. And I take it for pursuing his counterclaims as well.
Well, not so much for pursuing his counterclaims, but right, having
but
to defend them.
If he's not, I don't want to rush you because your time's running out. If he's not pursuing fees for pursuing his counterclaim, why is he asking for 100% of the total attorney's fees that he incurred? And how are we supposed to parse that out if he's not asking for the counterclaim?
Well, here's the point. None of these attorney's fees would have had to been expended at all if the plaintiffs hadn't brought a groundless and frivolous lawsuit to start with. Because there's no question, they certainly knew about the easement. All they had to do was, there was nothing they had to do. They put this litigation in place to thwart Mr. Bailey from building a road.
Never asked for injunctive relief, did they?
No, but the
Mr. Bailey could have built his road.
Mr. Sheridan testified at trial that the town would not approve the permit until the litigation was resolved.
You better take your time.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Catherine Silburn, attorney number 34669. I'm with the law firm of Odell and Silburn, and I'm here on behalf of the defendants and cross-appellees Thaddeus Ragsdale and Darla Davis, collectively known in the briefing as the Ragsdales. I'm here basically to argue that the standard here, this is the first I've heard that it might be de novo, but my understanding and my position, my client's position, is that it is abuse of discretion, and that that is how we are positioned in terms of No, sir. My understanding was that the opening brief stated that it was abuse of discretion, and that is what I agreed to at the beginning of my argument section. So my understanding here today was it was abuse of discretion, which...
And as I understood the argument, it was a misapplication of legal standard to undisputed facts.
That is correct.
As I understood, that's what the appellant was arguing. There was a misapplication of the legal standard to undisputed facts.
That's correct, Your Honor.
If the facts are undisputed, maybe it may be a legal question.
Well, it certainly may in terms of, I mean, I suppose that is possible, but in terms of the allotment or award of attorney's fees, Mr. Bailey filed the motion for fees and a bill of costs. We responded. There was no reply and no request for a hearing. So I would submit to the court that the appropriate time to raise such an issue would have been then.
Well, let me ask you this. Was it disputed in the record that the Ragsdales knew that there had been an easement? And was it disputed that basically there was no evidence to support any of the multiple defenses that they came up with?
Well, it certainly was disputed, but the court specifically found in its August 7th, 2008 summary judgment order, it's the second to the last sentence, at this time the court does not find that plaintiffs' claims and defenses lack substantial justification and the request for attorney's fees is denied.
And that's a conclusion that the court made. The question I ask you is there a conflict in the evidence whether or not the Ragsdales knew about the easement or didn't know about the easement at the time they initiated litigation? Is there a conflict in the evidence presented in the case?
There is a conflict in the evidence, Your Honor.
Next question. Is there a conflict in the evidence concerning whether or not the Ragsdales had any evidence to support any of their defenses in the case?
Yes, I believe they had evidence to support their, particularly their understanding was that they bought raw agricultural land that had merged back and extinguished the easement. And they have an affidavit of Mary Wakefield saying it was raw agricultural land. They wanted it for cows and horses. And so there was a good faith belief. And as far as title commitments, absolutely. But I have to tell you, title commitments make mistakes. I have four of them right now I'm dealing with. An easement just down the street that goes back 101 years. And subsequent to 1970, there's been an error regarding that easement. It happens. So I don't think that's the only thing you can go on here. And our client and my client, although I have to tell you it was prior counsel, it wasn't myself, I didn't come on until the eve of trial, but I have to say that there was a good faith belief, and my clients would stand here today and say, look at our deed, it's raw agricultural land, and that was their understanding. But it was also a handshake deal. This was a very, they didn't understand. And the fences that were across it, I have to say, they didn't put them up. They did not put the fences, those were there when they got them. And they said, if we take them down now, Your Honor, our horses will be all over the place. And they did take them down, granted at the last, and they got dinged for that. They did get dinged by that, by the court. But they also won significant portions of this case. Namely, Mr. Bailey wanted them to pay a very high percentage of the costs of this road and interpreted the declaration on his own. So the idea there would have been no litigation had my clients not filed their quiet title is simply not true. There would have been a whole issue about costs, and that was the second round of summary judgment motions. And my client prevailed on that and is paid significantly less of the portion that Mr. Bailey was claiming he had to pay for the cost, the ultimate cost of the road.
And that was the part of the case that went to 4 days of trial.
Well, no, Your Honor, that was ruled on summary judgment. What went to trial, and we tried to.
The damages were ruled on summary judgment?
Yes, the court ruled that they would pay no more than 12.5%. The trial was about the trespass on the easement, and the Mr. Bailey wanted to have damages be an element of the damages on the trespass claim, which the court specifically found in its five-page order after the trial that it wasn't going to allow. There was no statutory exception, nothing that would provide in the law for damages. For attorney's fees as a category of damages for trespass.
Bailey's trespass claim, not your client's. Your client's got it.
That's correct.
Bailey had a counterclaim.
Too slow for the court.
So this is the same question I was trying to get at before. If Mr. Bailey went to trial on his trespass claim, a substantial amount of time was spent on that claim. Is he asking here, and was he ever asking below, for fees for pursuing his counterclaim? If not, it seems like the asking for 100% doesn't apply here. This doesn't work.
Well,
can you explain to me a little bit about that, and maybe council can respond? That's what I'm trying to get for.
Yes, Your Honor, I will try. The court, in the first and second orders on summary judgment, in the first one, it addressed attorney's fees. And then it addressed it again, not in the second summary judgment order, but in the trial court order. And basically, it said it would decline because the benefits, and I'm quoting, the resolution of these matters resulted in rulings that included benefits for Bailey and for plaintiffs. The issues involved in the quiet title actions of plaintiffs and defendant Bailey, as well as his declaratory judgment claim, are intertwined. The court finds that with respect to this aspect of the litigation, plaintiffs' claims and defenses were not groundless, frivolous, and vexation. The court denies an award of attorney's fees. So instead of paying attention to that in terms of splicing out the quiet title action from the defense of the claims of trespass and harassment, which were withdrawn and not at issue during the trial, Mr. Bailey claimed fees for the entirety of the litigation. We submitted, in response, an affidavit from an expert who reviewed the entirety of their bills going back to the inception of the lawsuit. The attorney reviewed those, looked at it, and her figure that she came up with was $2,500 because she looked at all the time entries, what was spent on the defense of these claims. The court did not award $2,500. Instead,
the $2,500 that your expert opined upon was what she found were the costs expended to defend the trust, the first and second. And the judge went beyond the $2,500.
He went beyond it by $8,000, Your Honor.
So what was the other $7,500 based upon that?
His reasoning was that, I think, essentially, that he was looking at that even though on the line items of the time entries, that he was trying to include the defense of the action in the whole and parsing out. And he felt that a larger number, I mean, he basically says, I'm just looking for it, if I can have a moment. He's very, it's in the bill of order on the bill of costs. He states that, having presided over the entirety of this case, the court can characterize the party's focus during the litigation as centering on the claims regarding the deprivation of defendant's access to his property, the construction of a road on the Evergreen Trail easement, and financial responsibility for that road. He goes on to say, nonetheless, the plaintiff's complaint sought monetary damages against defendant in connection with the trespass and harassment claims and certainly created an issue requiring serious legal attention until plaintiff's actual withdrawal of the claim in January 2009. In addition to the attorney's fees that can clearly be attributed to the trespass and harassment claims, a portion of the general work performed in connection with defending against plaintiff's claims prior to the withdrawal of the trespass and harassment allegations is applicable to those claims. The court finds that $10,500 in attorney's fees were reasonable and necessary incurred in connection with the defense against plaintiffs' first and second claims for relief. So he clearly analyzed the issue of the whole versus the defense of these claims, and he really did come to a middle ground.
That also, that's what I was asking counsel about. I know he says that these are for the first and second claim, but I read that paragraph more or less the way you read it. That's what I was trying to get clarification. And in terms of the defense, the pursuit of the counterclaims, did he ever make a ruling that the defense of the counterclaims by the Ragsdales was frivolous and groundless?
No.
Was he asked to?
No.
Yet they're asking for 100% of their fees, if I'm not mistaken.
You are correct, and they did so in their motion for fees, but again, they never replied to our response, and they never asked for a hearing at that time. And I think that in light of that, the review should be abuse of discretion here, and that the trial court's acknowledgement that the claims and defenses of the action are intertwined, and that the Ragsdales won significant aspects of this case, that should be noted.
Okay.
that we did not just, and even when there is, I mean, the case law is very clear that awarding just for certain claims and defenses, even with when there has been bad faith, I don't deny that. My client said those things to Mr. Bailey. He said that on the stand that he did. But he felt very threatened by Mr. Bailey, and it was a very bad situation. There's no question.
In the application for attorney fees, did Mr. Bailey break out what fees apply to what claims?
No. We only had review of the entirety of their billing records and also prior counsel's billing records.
So there was no basis in the application for the attorney fees for the judge to have looked at it and determined that Bailey's application would have supported $10,500 on just the trespass and the other claim as well?
No, and the court actually does note that if you're only going on the times that it's mentioned, that the affidavit of our expert was, in fact, it did come out to around $2,500, if that's all you were going on. But he expanded that, I think, in an effort to be fair.
He didn't find that the entirety of Bailey's attorney fees were unreasonably spent in defense of this litigation, did he?
No, he did not. Shall I go on? Where shall I pick up from there?
Balls in your court.
Well, I simply want to say there has been a mention of delay. The record shows that any delay in this action was the fault of Mr. Bailey, not the Ragsdales. He had much difficulty serving all the landowners in this action. In fact, the court never mentions in any of its orders that delay is a basis for an award of fees in this action. Moreover, the record supports the trial court's award of fees in that there is no legal or factual basis for awarding additional fees. In terms of its bill of costs and attorney's fees, Mr. Bailey's counsel had the opportunity to do an analysis of its own bills and parse them out. And indeed, the court's order impliedly requested that by saying, I'm not awarding fees for these. I do not find that the quiet title action was groundless or vexatious, but I am saying that the defense of these claims, there is an award of fees, and instructed the submission of a motion and would countenance that on a Rule 121 motion for fees and costs. That was completely ignored by counsel for Mr. Bailey. The entirety of their bills from the inception of litigation on was submitted.
And after your expert submitted her affidavit as the amount of fees, they didn't file a reply to that?
They did not file a reply nor request a hearing. I have just a few seconds left and would just like to say that the record demonstrates that the trial court's decision fell within a range of reasonable options. And that is really what the abuse of discretion review is about. It's not whether they got it absolutely right or wrong. It's a range of reasonable options, and the decision of the trial court at every juncture was not an abuse of discretion. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Let me address some of the issues that were raised. One, Bailey did specifically ask for attorney's fees for having had to defend the quiet title action. If you look at the opening brief, we specifically cite a section in the motion for summary judgment, section F, that says the defenses asserted by the plaintiffs are completely and totally frivolous. And so for having to defend those affirmative defenses, we should get attorney's fees and costs. And not only that, the court court...
This is in what document?
The motion for summary judgment, which the court granted in August of '08. And then the court denied attorney's fees and costs, and we asked for a motion for reconsideration to be able to bring those back up at the trial. And the court did grant that motion specifically and separately. And so we were allowed to bring the attorney's fees and costs issue of having to defend the quiet title action even through trial, and having had to defend our quiet title action for which there was no affirmative defense. So that's what the court ruled on at trial. So there's two ways that Bailey should have gotten his attorney fees. One, having had to defend the quiet title action, which the plaintiffs continued to argue through trial. And two, having had to support our affirmative action for our counterclaim for our deck action.
Counsel said that you didn't ask for attorney's fees for the counterclaim, nor did you parse out or separate out your attorney's fees too.
Well, she says that, but that's not what the record shows. I mean, even in the motion for summary judgment in the proposed order, we asked for attorney's fees for having had to defend the plaintiff's complaint with respect to the right-of-way.
And the counterclaim are, to me, are two different things. I understand the claims are intertwined, but they're the language is different. But asked for fees for pursuing your counterclaim and established that their defense to the counterclaim is frivolous or groundless or both.
We sure did. In fact, if you look at the order that the judge entered, and I'm sorry, I don't know the date off the top of my head. I believe it was in December, because in the second motion for summary judgment, we raised the issue again, and we asked the court, since we were so close to trial in December, we asked the court to reserve it for the February trial, and he said he would. And so we sure did ask for him. And my recollection of the procedure with respect to the affidavit of the attorney, it's not that there wasn't a response filed to it. We had already filed our motion and laid out our attorney's fees and costs and what we received. And you have to keep in mind in this case two in the underlying action, there was actually a dispute on an attorney's lien filed by Mr. Bailey's former attorney, and we had a hearing before Judge Holmes going into detail out of both bills of who had done what and who was entitled to what. We eventually settled that, and the amount, the $10,500 was split between the attorneys based on allocation of costs that we had determined was for that claim, and all of Mr. Bailey's costs were paid. And the damages determined at trial were for damages for trespass of his easement by the plaintiffs. The plaintiffs effectively trespassed the easement by trying to prevent him from using it. And so we said, because they had no defenses to that claim, to us using the easement, the attorney's fees and costs should be awarded against them for that reason.
And when did the court rule on that?
The court ruled on that.
By denying the fee, by only allowing fees for the first and second claims? I don't see them specifically addressing the request for fees on the counterclaims. I don't see that in the order.
Yes, but if you look at the request throughout the proceeding by the plaintiffs, they repeatedly asked for that, and he denied it. And maybe we have to go into the transcript of the court's ruling at trial, other than just the order.
Is that part of the record?
I do not know off the top of my head.
It's not.
I know.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for the briefs and arguments. The case will be deemed submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.
Thank you.
The next case is Bert Simpson, actually not at all, Bert Simpson Law Firm in the city of Simpson. Mr. Simpson,